This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Dr. Daryl Lismore. How are you?
That's also right. I'm well. Thank you very much, Chris.
Excellent. We're here in Lincoln. It's probably, I think this must be either my first or second trip ever to Lincoln. I went to university in Christchurch, Canterbury. But doing engineering, but I never actually made it out to sunny Lincoln.
Well, welcome. nice to have you.
What we're going to do today is we're going to talk a lot about genetics. Your role here is?
My role is Principal Research Scientist for Grapevine Improvement. Lead the Grapevine Improvement Program for New Zealand wine growers.
And that's really on the genetic side.
That's right, yeah.
And you have got a brand new toy.
We do. We've got a few new toys. Probably the one you're referring to is a sequencer that we've had for a little while in the laboratory now. We're effectively a fairly new team, and what we mean by grapevine improvement is improving the genetics of grapevine, selecting better plant material.
What we're going to talk about today is, I want to set the scene because people hear about different things about genetics, but there's different approaches to improving genetics. Some are adding genes, some are taking genes out, some are just doing all sorts of weird stuff. So I want to set the scene and understand what the options are for a geneticist to do things. And I don't want to get into the ethics of it too much, but if there's something that's clearly bad or considered bad by certain groups, then maybe we can highlight that a little bit. But so let's start off with what people have done in the past.
Right.
And that is plant breeding, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. So grapevines are effectively the world's oldest domesticated fruit crop, which is quite exciting. There has been grapevine improvement done on grapevines before there was that done on almost all other plant species.
Even wheat?
Wheat, probably earlier. So in terms of fruit crops, grapevines definitely the first, but people were probably collecting seed from seed-propagated crops and wheat and certain vegetables a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what plant breeding, what do you do there?
Yeah, so plant breeding is kind of a catch-all term for the artificial improvement of a plant, and typically what the scientific term would be hybridization. You're taking two different individuals and mixing their genetics and collecting a diverse panel of offspring, and in the case of plants, planting them out and then selecting a subsequent generation from what looks good out of that collection.
So the plants are going through just natural sexual reproduction.
Exactly.
And you're getting, and in this case, you're getting a seed and you're planting it in the ground and you're going, is this a good plant?
That's right. So every single bunch of grapes, every seed in those grapes is genetically unique, just like the children of parents. And if you grow up individual plants from them, they're all genetically different.
So in the old days, people would just get seeds from grapes, put them in the ground and go, oh, I like this one. This makes a nicer grape.
That's right.
Than the old one. But then people started getting a little bit more clever because they'd say, oh, I like this particular grape. Let's call it Pinot Noir.
Yes.
And go, oh, this one's a little bit different.
Exactly.
And then that was called?
In the nursery, we call them bud sports, and the process would be clonal selection.
Clonal selection, yeah.
So there are multiple commercial clones of all of the major grape varieties. They all come from they can all be traced back to one individual seed, the same seed. So all Pinot Noir plants come from one Pinot Noir individual seed that was once selected hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And what happens is as a plant grows, to grow more branches and leaves, it has to replicate its cells, has to make new cells, and every time a cell divides, it has to copy all of the DNA. And in the case of grapevine, there's about 1 billion letters of code. And so those enzymes that do that copying of the DNA, they are very high fidelity, but they make some errors. So as the plant grows, it's making small random changes to its genetics. Those can also happen when the DNA is damaged, like from UV light, and then repaired incorrectly. And those random genetic changes lead in some cases to slight trait differences. So Pinot Noir is a great example because Pinot Blanc is actually not genetically a different variety. Pinot Blanc is a mutant. It's a plant that has a small point genetic change has broken its ability to produce anthocyanin. The color that produces the red skins in the berries. And as a result, you get white berries. Otherwise, it's basically the same as Pinot Noir.
Yeah, so you'd almost say Pinot Blanc and Pinot Gris are clones of Pinot Noir, but we sort of treat them differently, don't
we? We would, exactly. So from a geneticist perspective, they're clones, but for a winemaker, they're new varieties. Sometimes, it's an interesting one, sometimes when the spontaneous genetic change drifts so far apart, you almost have to label it a new variety for winemaking.
Mm. Yeah, you see that with Gewürztraminer and...
Exactly. But certainly Gewürztraminer and Traminer, it's spicy Traminer. The change there is not a color one, but it's changed the biochemistry of that berry to the extent that the wine it makes is so different. From a winemaker's perspective, there, treat them as a different variety.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and that's clonal selection. And we're not really changing the genes, although the genes are being changed. It's just that it's happening over time in the vineyard, and it can take hundreds of years for these things to come through. And someone goes, oh, I like that.
That's right.
And then they start propagating that new plant material, and all of a sudden you've got a different clone of the same grape variety.
That's right.
And that's the way a lot of genetics, both plant breeding and clonal selection, has been done up till, 50 years ago?
That's right, yeah. That brand, that varietal identity of Pinot Noir or Chardonnay has been so powerful in the market that people have basically gone to clonal selection for their improvements. And they would typically do that by going to very old vineyards because they've had time to accumulate that random genetic diversity.
They used to call it mesal selection or mass selection?
Yeah, so mass selection means rather than taking an individual that you are cloning through propagation, you go to a vineyard and take a whole lot of cuttings. And so you're propagating a set of individuals of that.
Oh, okay. So it's slightly different. So you haven't got a homogenous vineyard you're planting.
That's right.
You've got some varietal difference in there.
Yeah, some clonal diversity that you're maintaining.
Okay, now we're going to get into modern technology and genetics. So the next one is induced mutation, because that's something you guys are doing here. So what's that?
That's right. So because mutations are a source of useful genetic diversity, and because they happen slowly and at random, people came up with the idea of let's understand why mutations occur and actually make them happen at a higher rate. And it's crude ways of doing that initially were like the Atoms for Peace program, where they decided let's find some useful ways to use atomic energy, and they planted a whole lot of plants around sources of radiation. The radiation damages DNA. Sometimes the host organism can't repair it in the right way, and so you get a lot of diversity. And there have been a few different, so in addition to radiation, there's chemical approaches that you can use, but basically it's taking advantage of that resource of genetic diversity and usually stepping it up a notch so that you have a population where, rather than maybe in a vineyard, one in every 1,000 or 100 plants have some useful genetics, it's happened 100 times more frequently, so every plant is visibly different.
I mean, I looked at it and they've got terrible names. Chemical mutagenic, is that right?
Yeah.
That's where you have a chemical, and I've been watching too much Marvel comics, I think. Hulk, gamma rays.
Yeah, that's
the
right.
The Hulk. And what's the other one? Tissue culture stressing as well.
That's right. Yeah. So it basically, anything that damages DNA or puts stress on the genome can cause these random changes to accumulate at a greater rate. And mutations have such a negative connotation because typically they make things worse. Mm. Generally, over time, evolution has selected for things that perform really well. And so most random changes are going to make something worse. And people's context of mutations is usually things like cancer. Something has broken the DNA,
yeah.
It hasn't been fixed properly, and you have some quite bad outcomes. But mutations are also the source material for evolution. Where sexual recombination just shuffles what's already there, the new diversity has to come from somewhere, and it comes from these mutations over time. So all the good traits also come from random mutations.
I imagine the failure rate is quite high, so you're doing it and you might have to do thousands and thousands and then go, oh, that one, A, it survived.
That's right.
And then, oh, it's got a tray that you want.
Exactly. So because most of the diversity is going to be worse, you have to produce thousands. It's basically, if you think of any trait like height in humans, if you have a clonally propagated organism like grapevines, they're all genetically identical for that trait, so there's nothing to pick an improvement from. But if you produce random diversity, a key trait for us is timing of bud burst because of the susceptibility to spring frosts. If you have a bit of diversity, some of those plants are going to go through budburst a little early, some a little later, but now you have a bit of a bell curve and you can go to the edges of that collection of plants and select plants that have the trait that you want, as long as you have some source of diversity to pick from.
And then we start getting into gene editing, where you're going in and you're changing things. The one that most people get a little bit upset with is transgenic modification.
Yeah.
And what's that one?
So transgenics, the trans means across. You're taking some DNA from something else and putting it in. And one of the most amazing things about genetics is that the DNA code is functionally the same. It's the same molecular basis in all organisms. So you can take something from a different organism, put it into another, and it'll work. It'll be expressed. So that's transgenic. When something's come across, it couldn't have happened through sexual propagation. So it couldn't have happened in nature because those two organisms couldn't breed.
That's right. So there's things like where they make fish glow in the dark or fluoresce or something, isn't it?
Yes, and that's mostly been done as a proof of concept. If you're doing anything in genetics, if you're developing the method, you need something that validates that the method worked. So those fluorescent proteins came from jellyfish, and people thought, if I want to work out, can I put something into even my grapevines? Using a fluorescent protein is a good one, because if the grapevine starts to fluoresce under UV light, then it worked. And then you can swap it for something more useful later on.
And that whole transgenic stuff really took off with the development of CRISPR-Cas9, which is the sort of molecular scissors, isn't it? So you could control where you cut the DNA and inserted things.
That's right. So CRISPR-Cas9 is adapting a system in bacteria that is for viral defense, which removes something that's, in the case of the original use case, it was removing a virus. But you can remove something that you would normally be there. The advantage of the CRISPR system is you can target it to a specific site. So they take the enzyme from bacteria. They also take a guide RNA, which tells it what to cut. And then you can put those two ingredients into any organism. And then the guide RNA will tell it which gene to damage. So if we use radiation or chemical mutagens, they just damage things at random. The advantage of CRISPR is you can basically damage something very precisely.
Yeah, so if you wanted to turn Cabernet Sauvignon white, you could target the bit that makes the colours and go set it up, and then you could make a white Cabernet Sauvignon. And that's not transgenic in that case, is it? What's that called? Where you're not adding new genes, you're just knocking out genes.
That's right. And there isn't a good set of terms here, and that's part of the problem, in that gene editing means we've changed what's there. You can have transgenic gene editing, where you've had to introduce some new genes to do that, and usually what they're doing is they're introducing the CRISPR enzyme from bacteria. Or, rather than introducing the code for the CRISPR enzyme, more recently people actually take the CRISPR protein itself with the guide RNA, introduce just those two components, which is hard because they're really big. But if you can get those into the cell, they can make the cut without introducing any foreign DNA. So you can make a specific cut in a specific location of the DNA without introducing a DNA. Technically, that's non-transgenic gene editing. And the really interesting thing about that is it just makes a break, which is something that happens all the time.
It's like a clone, isn't it? But it's exactly what you want.
That's right.
Is there any examples that you might want in vines to do that for?
Yeah, so there are some great examples. People initially, when breeding and transgenics were the main options for plant improvement, there was a lot of focus on resistance genes, genes that have evolved in one organism to confer resistance to a pathogen. But now with gene editing, people have started studying susceptibility genes, genes that have to be there in the host for the pathogen to manage an infection. And there are quite a lot of those. Those are being found as susceptibility genes for viruses and powdery mildews in grapevine, for example. And so CRISPR would be a way of knocking those out, removing a susceptibility gene as opposed to introducing a resistance gene.
Okay, and what's that called? Does it have a particular name? Just gene editing or?
Yeah, just gene editing and targeting a susceptibility gene.
But not all genes need to be switched on and off. There's an area known as epigenetics.
That's right.
Do you want to explain what that is? Because that's different. That's not really changing the gene, but it's changing the way the traits are.
Exactly. So every cell inherits the DNA of the cell that it replicated from. So it has all of the genes. But the question is, why do some cells become leaves and some cells become roots. And that's because only certain genes have to be expressed to make the tissue and perform the functions of that tissue. And so epigenetics is a layer on top of the DNA which causes some of the DNA to be expressed and some of it to be silenced so that it's not being expressed. Controls which genes are being expressed in a specific cell at any one time.
Yeah, and epigenetics is one of the reasons. You can tell me, I'm not sure if I'm right sure. here, but if you plant a grapevine in a particular location and plant it in a completely different location, sometimes the vine will grow differently, and that's epigenetics?
Part of it, yes. There's, of course, an environmental effect. If the vine's been exposed to more sunny days, the fruit will ripen faster. But also, the vine, just in being exposed to higher sun, different microorganisms in the environment, does actually start to change over time which genes are switched on and which are switched off. So a member of our team, Chen Liao, went and collected the exact same samples from the exact same clone of Sauvignon Blanc in different parts of the country, and it did methylation sequencing, which is looking at the epigenetics of those samples. And although they have the same genotype, the same DNA, their methylation is specific to the region that we picked them from.
And if you move the plant to another region and plant it, will those genes then get turned back to what they were? So if you swap those two plants around, would they start looking like the plants from that region?
That's a great experiment. And we've never done that precise experiment. We've got a sort of proxy for that in that all of the material comes from a small number of nurseries. So we can say, what if materials collected by the nursery in one place, grafted, and then sent to multiple different places? And then we see it does, over time, adapt to the epigenetic pattern of the location that it's found, that it's then.
Okay. Is there an analogy with humans? Is there one that we could use?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a good one. Most epigenetic changes in response to stress, and so there's a great study, I'm hesitant to say where it was because I'm probably wrong, that looked at mothers whose food intake had been limited in the war. I think it might have been in the Korean War. And through that exposure to low amounts of food intake, their epigenetics had changed and it had been passed on to their offspring, and their offspring had sort of an adaptation that had been inherited from the stress response. The strongest changes to epigenetics generally are from environmental stress.
All right, and then once we've gotten to that, there's a thing which I've never really come across before called RNA-based spray-induced gene silencing.
That's right.
So that's where you're spraying something, is that right?
Yes. So DNA is the recipe book. It's everything that the information of how to make all the enzymes, which are the molecular machines. For traits to be expressed, the regions of the DNA have to be transcribed into RNA. So the genes that are being expressed become transcribed as RNA, and then the RNA is translated into proteins. So if you can interrupt that process, you can, without changing the DNA, you can either remove the RNA that's being transcribed or change the RNA that's being transcribed. And that can be guided by RNA that's applied externally. So it's sort of a signaling molecule that can be hacked into in an organism to change the traits that are expressed without changing the DNA.
And by changing the RNA of the plant temporarily, you change a molecule and that can change some traits.
That's right. You might want to slow down ripening or trigger a stress response, for example.
Mm. And RNA can be used, you call it SIGs, is that right?
Yeah, some people do. It's often referred to as, technically, as RNA interference. It's using these double-stranded RNAs. RNA is usually single-stranded in the plant, but double-stranded RNA is most commonly encountered by the host as viruses. So they recognize this unusual type of molecule, and they start to chop it up, and then they chop up anything that looks like that. So they remove a lot of the RNA that matches the double-stranded RNA that was introduced.
When I was doing some research on this, it seemed that mold and mildews were quite a good target for this. If you can make the double RNA look like a mold and mildew, you can actually use that to attack or kill the mold.
That's right. That's often where it's been targeted. If you could find some kind of pest or pathogen, molds and mildews, and silence a targeted gene that is critical to their survival and sort of silence that. The other approach that we've been looking at is silencing one of these susceptibility genes, so in the host. Mm-hmm. So rather than editing it, removing it, just temporarily silencing the susceptibility gene. And in a collaboration with the University of Milan, we have a PhD student from Milan here at the moment, she's been studying whether you can introduce these double-stranded RNAs targeting susceptibility genes, and it looks like you can get some resistance to powdery mildew that way.
What I understand, and you can correct me, is it washes off and it doesn't really stick and it needs to be applied a lot, and so it's still quite embryonic.
That's right, it's very early stage, and the big problem with RNA is it degrades really quickly in the environment. It's ubiquitous. There's more RNA than there is DNA. Plants have one copy of the DNA and they just make lots and lots of RNA. So it's really abundant in the environment, but it degrades super quickly. So it's stabilizing it, getting it into the organism you're targeting. Those are the big challenges.
Okay, I think that's everything, is it? Have I missed something?
We briefly mentioned cisgenics.
Yes, yep.
Yeah, so cisgenics is the name given when you take a gene from something the host could have hybridized with, could have been bred with, and put it in directly. So for example, you might want to develop a disease-resistant Sauvignon Blanc that is resistant to powdery mildew. There are other species of grapevines that have resistance genetics in it, but if you cross them with Sauvignon Blanc, you end up with new seedlings. They are very genetically different, and that's where these new disease-resistant varieties or PRRS come from. But you can take just the resistance gene out of that species and put it into Sauvignon Blanc the way you would do transgenics. It's not transgenics in that you haven't introduced something that couldn't happen through breeding, but it has been done artificially. So that becomes a bit of a gray area of how it's regulated. You've achieved something that you've only introduced DNA that the plant could get through breeding, but you have done it in the lab and you haven't shuffled the genetics like normal sexual recombination would.
Yeah. In New Zealand, which ones have you been looking at here?
Yeah. So our lab isn't a quarantine facility. So most of the new tools, we have a very strange way of classifying what GMOs are in our country. And they depend on the approach you take. And if that approach was being used pre-1998, then it's not GMO. And if it's new, then it is GMO. And so we have intentionally used this random mutagenesis approach because it introduces random diversity. It's been done for decades. It does mean you have to make thousands of plants. So that's what we've been doing. We have gone through the whole process for gene editing except for making the gene edits. We can't do that. We'd have to get license and we'd have to do it in a lab that is basically regulated as if it was outside of New Zealand. So just bringing them out of a quarantine lab is treated the same way as if you were to bring in a new species across the border. Mm-hmm. But we think that could be a potentially valuable new tool, especially this non-transgenic gene editing approach, where you make a targeted change of the same type that we make through random mutagenesis, but exactly at the site that you want.
Well, I think next week we're going to look at your Sauvignon Blanc 2 project, where you're creating all these different mutations and seeing what's going on there.
Sounds good.
All right. Cheers very much.